Hello, I am Casey. I'm a compulsive reader and a bulimic. I want to thank Ellie in absentia for asking me to share and Nick for supervising me. My story is unusual. It probably isn't unique. I don't know if it is, but it's unusual. And when I share at large groups, I try to make it less about the particulars and more about the things we have in common. The first step of the first word of the first step is we. So I'm going to get my particulars out of the way and then talk about the spiritual stuff because that we all have in common. My particulars are that I've almost died from food-related causes, not counting food poisoning I've had in the last year or so, five times. My mother had toxemia. I mean, me and my metabolism are not friends. Or I guess I'm learning that we are friends, that we're the same thing, but I walked in this program thinking we were not friends. My mother had toxemia. I was induced, so I was being poisoned in the womb. I was born with something they called celiac. It probably isn't, because I now know that celiac is uncurable, but it was its first cousin or whatever it was. And for the first 2.5 years of my life, I lived on only soy milk and eventually soy milk and bananas. I then got over whatever that was, and at the age of 6 developed the case of those scary, scary allergy stories. I was allergic to more things than I wasn't until I was about 12. I broke out in hives and was only hospitalized once over that event, but you know, a long list of foods I couldn't eat. I was not by any means obsessed with food. I had a not passionate affair with food. During that time, I didn't resent it enormously. I'll get to my life in a minute. But from the time I was 12 till the time I was 21, I had a normal, supposedly, metabolism and relationship with food. At 21, I became a type 1 diabetic. All of those first four events, none of them were in any, you know, except deeply psychological way, if you think of it that way, I don't, caused by me. The fifth one was caused by me, and that's what got me in this program. The fifth one was in 2001. I was in New Hampshire I wasn't living in New Hampshire. I was already living here, so I'll back up in a minute. But I caused myself to go into extreme ketoacidosis. I was hospitalized. My father asked the doctor at that point if I would live. He was with me. He said, "I think so. I've only read about this in textbooks." Well, it was because he was in a small hospital in a small town in New Hampshire. I knew I would live. I'd been sicker in my life before, but I was in and out of consciousness, so nobody was asking me. I would have assured my father. So, my story is I grew up in New York City. I was raised by a true narcissist, and he diagnosed by people besides her daughter. And it was not easy. You know, I was supposed to be exactly who she wanted me to be. And fortunately, I was in many ways who she wanted me to be, but mostly from the eyebrows up. She's smart and clever. I'm smart and clever. We can be smart and clever together. We hung at museums. We read books. We went to intellectual movies. And I did all of that stuff from a fairly young age. I'm too smart for my own good. I'm one of those people. You know, they sometimes say that you can't be too dumb for the program. You can be too smart for the program. And it's been the thing I've been trying to tamp down ever since I walked into 12-step programs. And I'm getting better at it. So I lived in New York City my whole life. What happens to people who are raised by narcissists is one of two things. We either implode and can get suicidal later or homicidal, or we explode and latch on to many, many, many other people who will take care of us. So I did the latter, and I developed a coterie of friends, some of them real sincere friends, some of them real people who care about me and who I care about. I ended up in not a traditional helping profession, but a helping profession. I help people do things that they care about, mostly career related. And it worked. It worked. You know, I never felt good about myself. I really didn't feel good about myself. My first long-term therapist says in my early 20s when I walked in there, I said, I don't remember it, but I'm sure she's not lying. She said, I said that I am my mother. About 4 years later, I said, I'm not my mother. I'm a lot nicer than my mother. But, you know, so that's how effective the narcissist's childhood was. And what happened is that my husband, who I married young and who loves me, we'll get to the miracle part of that or not miracle part of that, I hope, before this ends. But, you know, it's had a job that was worth moving for. So I picked up thousands and thousands of relationships and left them. I didn't pick them up. I left behind thousands of relationships. Dozens of people who I really loved and who loved me. Hundreds of people who I cared about a lot and cared about me. And thousands of people who I knew and could always be with. So if I didn't feel good about myself, which was frequent, daily, it didn't matter. Because I would arrange to have breakfast or lunch or coffee or a business meeting with somebody. And they would feel good about me, so I would feel good about me. It worked. It really worked. It worked for years. Until I moved to California and nobody felt good about me. Nobody felt bad about me. Nobody knew me. You know, all of a sudden it was like I had to be with me and I don't like me. This is not good. So I used the other substance, 2XS first, that program too. And then I put that down after I was here a couple of years. And surprise, it's the old whack-a-mole game, yeah? Right? So you put down one thing, and the other thing pops up. And I had, over the years, as a type 1 diabetic, basically insulin is what helps you metabolize food, and I don't have any of my own. So if I didn't want to metabolize things I ate, I didn't take the insulin. It's a form of bulimia. It's called diabulimia. It's psychologically identical to bulimia. And I'd do it for a day or a half a day or a couple of days. But when I put down the other substance, I wanted to eat because I needed something. So I then did it for longer periods, more intensely, and I got myself very, very sick. As I say, I was hospitalized in New Hampshire. Because I had been in the other program, I knew the steps. I only know how to live life two ways, anesthesia or steps. And, those are my choices. And I wish you the kind of desperation that makes those your only choices. I assume you all liked anesthesia or you wouldn't be here, and I hope you like steps. So what happened is that I curled up in a fetal position in this hospital bed. Step one, no problem. I was there. I had almost killed myself and not wanted to. So step one, I got a problem. Steps two and three, I am doing in that fetal position, hoping that I can be restored to sanity, hoping that there's something other than me that can restore me to sanity because I wasn't doing a very good job. I thought it was more important to be thin than it was to be alive. I mean, not consciously, I didn't think that, but I was not wanting to metabolize my food and had made myself so sick that a doctor could say, I don't know if she'll make it for the next 24 hours. And again, it was one of those kind of eyebrows up intellectual things that in retrospect, it actually doesn't matter. I think I was sure I was going to make it. I might have been wrong. The doctor is the doctor. I wasn't. You know, I was just the patient. So in fact, I shouldn't be too smart. Maybe my confidence that I was going to make it was wrong. And doing step three, had to turn it over. I had heard of Overeaters Anonymous. I had never been to an Overeaters Anonymous meeting. And when I returned to California from New Hampshire, got out of the hospital, picked up a little bit at the end of that vacation, and came back, I called Central. Remember the days when you had to call? And I called. I said, could you send me a meeting list? They sent me a meeting list. I went to my first meeting on Hiroshima Day. I don't think that's an accident. In 2001, August 6, 2001. I walked in a bit late because I couldn't find it. It's the meeting on Hill Street, and it's not obscure. I just had never been to that particular part of Santa Monica before. So I was the one who raised my hand. Have any newcomers arrived after the start of the meeting? Yes. I was not struck abstinent. I was not struck abstinent. I was struck willing, but not willing to go to any lengths. You know, and I do believe that half measures avail us nothing in terms of complete recovery. I don't believe half measures avail us absolutely nothing. My physical health from that moment on was substantially better than it had been. It is now better than it's been maybe ever, but except pre-diabetic. But, you know, but it's, I wasn't entirely willing. During my first 4 or 5 months, during my first couple of years, I got days or weeks for months of abstinence. I was defining my abstinence at that point with the help of a sponsor as 3 meals a day, perhaps a snack, and anything that's needed for blood sugar. I always carry raisins. I mean, obviously, that's like medicine. So, I couldn't do that for more than 7 months at the most. It just wasn't how I worked. I'd like to have a different food plan than I have. I will get to my current abstinence because I went through some in between. But I'll be 7 years abstinent in October, so I know how exactly when. Almost 7 years ago, I had a sponsor who's actually in this room, who's not my sponsor anymore, but with a lot of love, said, "Why don't you find something that you can keep?" I'm very proud. And I said, "That's a good idea." So what my current abstinence is a real bulimic abstinence. If I eat it, I metabolize it. Most of the time, I mean really most of the time, like 95% or more of the time, I eat a healthy diabetic type 1 diet. But I'm not telling you I don't have a sandwich with 2 pieces of bread. I'm not telling you that occasionally there won't be ice cream in the house and I'll go decide to have half a pint. I mean, that's probably every third year, but it's not never. You know, I wish it was never, but it's not never. If I eat it, I metabolize it. If I eat it, I take insulin for it. And there are certain things you cannot take insulin in any regulated fashion for, like the half a pint of ice cream. So when I do that, I'm sick, but I'm not trying to purposely run high blood sugars to be thin like I used to. And that was its own kind of serious mental illness. Moving on to the steps, because there's not that much time left. So I burned out about 4 or 5 sponsors in the first 4 or 5 years. I burned them out in ways of not actually overusing them. They got annoyed at me because I was underusing them. You know, I have a sponsor in my other programs. I'm in 2. And one sponsor for both of those. And I had enough. I had psychotherapy, and I didn't really want to look at the food stuff. So after I changed my abstinence, I got a sponsor who I love and who we still love each other. She ended up leaving town. So that one didn't work, but that's the person I did my 4th step with, and my OA 4th step. And I did 2 interesting kind of OA 4th steps. There was another sponsor who I had for like 4 months, but it was an interesting experience. She's great. I haven't seen her lately. I hope she's still here. And so in chronological order, the first 4th step, I wrote down the people and situations and institutions I resented, and there weren't very many. And she said, "There's got to be more than this. There has to be more than this." I said, "There really isn't. I've worked through a lot of them. I believe, and when I have sponsees, I believe if it's not current, you know, we don't have to work on it." And she said, "Well, write down everybody you're annoyed with." I said, "That's a big list." That's a big list. So there were a lot of people, mostly in some situations, that were on that list. That was an interesting exercise. And then the person who moved away had me do the ACA, the Adult Children of Alcoholics 4th step, which is basically a narrative biography. I don't believe in them, but it was very helpful because that way, I don't believe in them as necessary, is a better way to put it. I believe in them. But she got to know me backwards and forwards from the moment I was born. And having somebody in program knowing, it took me about a year to write it. It is very long. I think there are like 140 questions, and if you answer them properly, it could take you a year. And I remember sitting in a rental apartment in Paris on a computer doing it. I mean, I could tell you places I did it. And That was a big deal because I looked at my story and it all boiled down to, you know, what do we hear about? We hear about fear. What do we hear about? It all boiled down to I am terrified of some things and afraid of many things. You know, so mostly I'm terrified of, you know, not being good enough, of not being worthy. When I said I once talked about the miracle or not miracle of my husband loving me as much as he does, and this has been a profound change for me in the last several years, perhaps by coincidence, but I don't think so, in really getting centered in my various addictions, and this was the final frontier. Although I'd like to get more settled, as I said, I'd like to have a food plan that never has me doing things, but for the moment that's a little too ambitious. So it used to, I never doubted that I had people who cared about me. I could see it. I could see it in their faces. I could see it in their actions. And, you know, I just thought it was a miracle. I was lucky. I had miracles. People who have miracles are extremely lucky, but that didn't mean I deserved it. It didn't mean that one day they'd wake up and figure it out. I mean, my husband and I have been married 35 years this past June, and I have friends who I've had that long. I have family members. My mother's not among them. That's the problem, right? I mean, she says she loves me. But when in a joint psychotherapy session many years ago, she was asked why she loved me, the first word out of her mouth was smart. So that's the problem, right? And, you know, so what, you know, it has seemed like less of a miracle, and it has seemed more like just the way the universe works. You know, I know that I love many of you in this room. I know that I love many people outside of these rooms. But more importantly, those of us who understand that level of fear, we're not the only ones, by the way. I think you're lucky if you've got an addiction. I think if you've got an addiction, what you have is a way out of that level of fear. What I have is a way out of that level of fear. I don't believe in a creative intelligence God. I begin most mornings, right now I've got a medical condition that has me not doing this for a few weeks, but I begin most mornings on my knees praying to a power I don't believe in. But that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. It centers me. It centers me with the universe. It centers me with myself. My in-laws moved in with us for many, many, many years. My mother-in-law died this December, will be 2 years. Her husband had died, I guess, about 2.5, 3 years before that. But it is no surprise. My husband married his mother. And so she and I have almost identical character failings. So she drove me wild. She drove me wild. She drove me crazy. And so right out of freedom from bondage, right? I prayed for her every morning on my knees for her to get everything I would want for myself. It didn't take 2 weeks. It says it takes 2 weeks. In her case, it took 5 months. And she's a good person. I'm a good person. It's just that we're mirrors to each other. Psychologically, we have a lot of different personalities and stuff. But, you know. And that means that 5 months out of about, other than 5 months out of about 10 years, I love that woman. That was a big deal. I would not have gotten that except for the book. When I sponsor people, and I do sponsor people, none of my sponsees are in this room right now, but I sponsor 3 people in LA. And I work food with them a little bit because I do think it's about food. I think it's often about food, but my food is so peculiar that I don't feel able to work food with people. I may get there. I work the steps. In fact, my most recent sponsee, who was going to be here, but she had to be in San Diego at noon, and that wasn't going to work, came up to me one day. I know her through a social group I'm in, and she knows that I'm in LA. And she said, "Would you sponsor me?" I said, "I don't." She said, "I have a sponsor." I said, "I don't know. You know, here's how I sponsor. You got to work the steps, and you got to work them hard. And we have to really do assignments." She's great. You know, I mean, my step one assignment if any of you are feeling new, or nobody raised their hand says actually new, is I want at least 3, and ideally no more than say 10, because they all end up looking identical. Stories about moments where food absolutely destroyed something in your life. My closest personal one is there's a woman I work for with, that's a strange line in that case, but who I liked and who adored her father. Her father died. And not suddenly, not, but he was an old man, but she loved him, and he died. I went to the funeral, and then I didn't go to the house of mourning because I thought the Burger King instead. I wanted to be there and support her, and I didn't. I made amends to her many years later, and she said, bloody. I'm sure she was in sorrow. There were, enough people in her home. But I made amends. We make the amends for ourselves. If we're forgiven, which we usually but not always are, that's a plus, but it's just a plus. So 10, 11, and 12, I heard a great share on 10 the other day, which I never focused on this being the primary aspect of 10, and it seemed right. I haven't investigated it enough to know if it's right, but I'll pass it on anyway, which is that what 10 is about is having the ability to observe yourself. That if we can actually see what we're doing, see what we're thinking, see, what we're feeling, that the rest of it will fall into place. That 10 is about giving up denial. And on a daily basis. I mean, maybe we gave up denial earlier, but giving up denial on a daily basis. So I hope I've helped somebody here, and I thank you. This is the time for questions only. There is no sharing of this meeting. If you need to share, please do so with any one of us after the meeting. Also, please remember that the opinions of the leader are my own and not those of Overeaters Anonymous as a whole. When asking questions, you need not identify yourself. Please remember, if you ask a question, your voice may be audible on the OA podcast. Because of the recording glitch today, I will be certain to repeat the questions because your voice will not be heard. Diane?
Thank you very much, Casey. Could you speak a bit of how you do a 10th step today?
Could I speak about how I do a 10th step today? Yes. There are two parts to the 10th step, but I'll speak about them both. The first part is when I am wrong, promptly admit it. I try to know when I'm wrong. I try to know when I've done something that I shouldn't have done. I occasionally get paranoid and have to check it out with somebody else, but I'm not sure, but usually I know. And I arrange to, if it's somebody I know well, I can get in touch with that person and say, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. I don't believe in I'm sorry. I believe I was wrong. I think there's a big difference. I was wrong to have done this, I won't do it again. Is there anything else I should know? It's like a traditional 9th step. On the inventory, I do inventory spottily. Do write gratitude lists when I'm feeling particularly ungrateful. I've been instructed to write daily gratitude lists. I don't. That's probably how I do my 10th step. Thank you. Yeah.
You said you've been married for over 37 years. How does your relationship look different
in abstinence? How does my marriage look different in abstinence? And by the way, it's interesting, if I said 37, we've been together 37, we're married 35, so that's a good 40 plus. But, it's much more sincere. It's much more sincere in abstinence. I don't hide anything anymore. Here's a funny story, and then we'll move on. After I did not yet have my current abstinence, but I was in one of those long-ish, for me, weeks or months periods of abstinence in the beginning of the program, and some friends came over with one of those Victor Benish alligator things, and a lot of it was left in a box. We had a dog who was a compulsive overeater. My experience is most dogs. Most dogs are compulsive overeaters. Like the one I have now is not, but most are. And so
the kitchen door was open, the dog ate all that stuff, and the next morning I got up, went to my husband and said, if you were planning on having that breakfast, he's a total normie. I said, the dog ate it. I was so happy that I was telling the truth. I was beside myself with joy. It's much more sincere. Yeah.
You talked about your ease in loving other people. What was the road to an obstacle to loving yourself?
I still have a hard-ish time loving myself. But what I do in the worst of those moments, do affirmations. I mean, the worst of those moments might be 3 or 4 times a year. But my sponsor in my other program, when I get really down, makes me do this. She says, I want you to write a list of all the things that are good about yourself. And, I could go on for a bit, you know. So that's what I do. Thank you.
It's good to hear you. So your mom, talk about some work that you've done as a program around your mom, and if there's any residual resentment, you want to get rid of it, and what can you do with
relationship with my mother, who is the only living parent still, and if there's residual resentment and how to get rid of it. Well, let me start by saying that I was supposed to be on a plane to visit my mother, who lives in South Florida. You know, old Jews go to the West Coast, old Wasps go to the East Coast, Wasps go to the West Coast. But, you know, she's there. I was supposed to be on a plane to see her next week. By having a large dog sit on my lap for hours, I developed phobitis. So I don't know if that was conscious or subconscious, but I can't get on that plane. So, I'll be there in September-ish is my guess. But I just come to, it's acceptance. It's acceptance. I'm not convinced I love her any more or any less than I've loved her for a long time. But it's a real Al-Anon program with her. I mean, it's release with love. If I didn't release her control over me, I was going to be in big trouble. So I had to release that. And now she and I are friends. Unfortunately, we were always friends. But I wanted more. Now I don't want more. So thanks.
So why do you like doing the lifeline?
Why do I like doing lifeline? Thank you so much. Because I think there's wisdom in lifeline. And although I've heard it from a few others in their lifeline pitches, I don't hear it that often. I always try to find at the most, say, 4 sentences, 1, 2, 3 sentences to read from Lifeline. I also really believe maybe this is just my way of caring about people. You know, my parents, by the way, were diehard, both of them, you know, activists, political people. I mean, I was raised in the civil rights movement. It had nothing to do with me. It just has to do with wanting to do the right thing for the world. And I do believe that Lifeline is crucial to people who don't have as many meetings as we do.
Yeah, following up on your question about your mother, that's how you're dealing with it now. How did you deal with the childhood memories and narcissism and the things that really affected you and shaped you?
With a lot of work. With a 3 program. Psychotherapy with various therapists, including one I'm in now. About 7 years ago, I bit the psychoanalysis bullet. You know, and, if anybody else is qualified as having a major eating disorder, which I don't know if just compulsive overeating counts in the law, it might, but certainly bulimia does, which I have, you've got a parity diagnosis. So I've got my psychoanalysis pretty much paid for by my insurance company. And, and work. It's work. It's not easy. And by the way, I have found, and a few of you have it, trolling the internet one night for narcissistic people. No, I mean, not looking for narcissists, looking for writing to them. I found what I think is the best, bar none, long article about narcissism. It reads like somebody's PhD thesis, so I don't know if it was, but I'm willing to share that with anybody who wants to give me their email address. It's fabulous. So.
Thank you.
Carol?
Thanks, Casey, for your share. Can you talk a little about working program around anxiety and the sort of feeling issues about? Do you struggle with that at all?
How do I work out my feelings of anxiety in program? I struggle with it a lot. My husband used to joke that it was my job to worry about nuclear holocaust and he would take care of most of the rest. I've maybe raised in the family I was raised in, but I do worry about things like nuclear holocaust, not to mention whether I will be okay at this speaking engagement, right? So it's a big gap there. I've learned to pause. I learned to reach out. When I was nervous about this speaking here this morning, I called my sponsor. We did get a chance to speak very briefly. I called one of my dearest friends, who's in my two other programs, but he's in a few others too. And he called back. We didn't connect easily, but I said, I want to pray with you on the phone. Well, I didn't pray with him on the phone. I prayed by myself because he didn't get to me in time or adequately full static. But, but I pray. I'm an atheist. I pray. And sometimes you just have to wait it out. I was prescribed an anti-anxiety medication that I should take on occasion. Well, my version of occasion has become almost never. The last time I took it, I think, was when my daughter, who I didn't even discuss, but that's another story. My daughter was going to be quite late for her grandmother, my mother-in-law's funeral, because she was, like, doing something else. So I think that's the last time I took one of those pills. Sandy?
Can you talk about your relationship with a power greater than yourself, being that you said you're somewhat of an atheist, and how that evolved?
How does this, my atheistic, self, come to a power greater than myself? I do believe we're all interconnected. I really do. I hope it's not too scientific for you, but I get comfort in the fact that the oxygen atom in me in a billion years might be the oxygen atom in the planet Neptune. That does give me some kind of safety of believing we're all interconnected. I don't think it's all beautiful. The only two people who God ever actually spoke to in the Old Testament both got majorly messed up. Job is one of my heroes. One of the physical things I suffered with as a result of my diabetes, there are a lot of stories there, was that because my blood sugars were so high, I developed some bad boils in France, and I was tortured literally in a parasol hospital. They poured salt on them and squeezed, and I was screaming. It was gone with the wind. When I got done, I read where boils were in the list of plagues. They're about the middle. There's six, I think. But you'll correct me next week if I'm wrong, or I'll correct myself. But how I believe in interconnectedness, it's not always enough. But because I have a lot of people in my life, the people are usually reminders of just how interconnected.
Do you have any siblings? And if so, how did you relate?
Oh, I don't have any siblings. It would have been helpful.
Can you talk about service and how it changed you?
I'd be happy to talk about service. I have in these rooms, these OA rooms, not this room in particular, although we talked about Lifeline. But I've been secretary, I've been treasurer, I've been Lifeline. Most recently, I was involved with the Region 2 Convention where Nick and I co-chaired the newcomer, and Pamela was running the thing. And other people, we have Diane and Jack here. It's a reminder to me that whenever I think I can get on my high horse and believe that I am not a part of the spirit of every brand new newcomer who walks in this room, that's one or five. Is that one or five? But not part of the spirit of every brand new newcomer. It reminds me that I am a newcomer, that I'm the person who said, when asked, has anybody come into the room since the meeting began, that I am that person, and I am that person daily. So thank you.
Thank you.
Reva.
Thank you for sharing. Tell us about your daughter. Do you have other children? Just one?
I have one daughter, two granddaughters. My daughter.
What are your relationship?
Well, but I'm going to tell you about my relationship with my daughter by telling you about how she relates to my disease. For years, as I say, I was not taking good care of my health before I moved to California, on and off, but, you know, not as badly as almost died, but badly enough that it wasn't good. And I know I was fertile during my fertile years, and not anymore, but I know I was fertile during my fertile years. And I chose to adopt because I didn't want to go through a diabetic pregnancy. That was not true. I have lots of friends, mostly in my diabetic support group, who have children who they've gone through the diabetic pregnancy. I didn't want to go through my diabetic pregnancy because I was taking such bad care of myself that I would have given birth to a possible vegetable. So one of the things I lost from my disease is having a birth child. One of the things she gained from my disease is being adopted by us. We were pretty good parents. But what happened is that there are sometimes in birth families too, but often in adopted families, just kind of mismatches. And I don't know how much you know about adoption. It's a long conversation, but we're a mismatch. And we tried hard, and she is somebody who I don't quite understand. She is clinically depressed, not totally out of life, but clinically depressed, on meds. She's got two husbands and two children. Our older granddaughter is the one we're closest to with the first husband, and she doesn't see that child anymore. She just doesn't see that child. We see that child often. She's, as my husband put it, she did a do-over. New husband, new baby. And it's very heartbreaking to me, another Al-Anon issue. So, thanks. Are we done? 2 minutes? I'll take repeats. Yes?
Thank you so much. You talked about your mom, so your first word is trying to be smart. Do you find that judgment come up in you and for other people?
Do I care about whether people are smart? Is that what you're asking? I care, but not in a heartfelt way. It took many, many years, but in my 20s I got this one. It wasn't many years, like recently. I don't think smart's a virtue. I think it's a tool. There are many smart, evil people. It's a good tool. I'm happy I have it. I may not always have it. I don't know. My mother's in her older years going, she's an alcoholic, so she's got, Korsakoff syndrome. It's like Alzheimer's, but a little, it doesn't get as severe. I notice, I guess that's the best way to put it, I notice. And when people aren't smart, then I just, have an easier time automatically, first off the bat, talking to those people from my heart. If I can't talk to you about, intellectual literature or politics, it's actually better for both of us.
You talked about having a vast number of friends. Do you have a handful of people who you can really open up and be intimate with?
Yes. When I say vast number, I have never counted. I probably should get my gratitude list, but I should figure out who I can really tell anything to. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's 5 or 6, and that's a lot. I think that's a lot. My husband's on the list, which I'm happy to say. So thank you.
You said that you were in other 12-step programs. How do you work balance yourself out between program and program?
How do I divide programs? Because I know we're running out of time. This is what I say often, but probably not in your presence before. The credits don't transfer. The study habits help. And the study habits do help. I go to, when I'm in L.A., which is much of the time, I go to probably about 10 or 11 meetings a week among the three programs. When I pick up commitments in one or the other or the third of the programs, I make sure not to overly book commitments in one program or else I won't get to the other ones, because I try to get my meetings done in the morning. You will almost never see me at an evening meeting unless I've been asked to share, you know, speak, to lead. So if I'm going to be done, this is the latest I ever get done. I get done on Saturdays and Sundays at 10. But I'm a morning person, so I go to a 7 to 8 a.m. meeting or a 7:30 to 8:30 a.m. meeting almost every day. Yeah. Okay.